Welcome to Conversations with David Lewis. Today, the generals. My guest is Thomas Ricks. He's been a military reporter for both the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal for decades, and he's written several books. The new one is The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today. Tom Ricks, thanks for being on the program.
Thank you for having me.
You start the book with the following dedication: for those who died following poor leaders. And the book seems to me to have a kind of underlying anger, perhaps. Am I wrong?
No, you're not. But there's also an admiration. The anger comes out of the Iraq War and partly also Afghanistan. Why were our generals so frequently mediocre in those wars? And why, when people failed, were they left in place? And what really struck me was this was a real departure from American military tradition. In the Revolutionary War, in the Civil War, in World War I, and especially in World War II, the tradition was the generals had a short amount of time to show themselves successful in combat. If they weren't, they were moved out. In World War II, you had about 90 days to be successful, to get killed or wounded, or to get fired. There were 165 men who commanded army divisions in combat in World War II. Of those, 10% were fired. You go into Vietnam and then especially into our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it seems like nobody ever got fired for anything. It seems that the only thing generals do get fired for mostly nowadays is for personal problems, moral lapses, what the military called zipper problems.
Or shooting your mouth off to Rolling Stone.
Yeah, but guys who, you didn't see people fired because, you know, he wasn't good at combat. He was not a good combat leader. That seemed just fine. So being a general nowadays in the U.S. military seemed to me to be a little bit like being a college professor, which is you could be a mediocre teacher as long as you kept your pants on.
You know, you start the book, and really the person you seem to admire the most that comes through in the book is General George Marshall.
Yeah, George Marshall really emerged from this book for me a real hero, somebody I wish Americans knew better. To me, he's the model of what a general should be like. A man of great integrity who made it his personal policy all his life to speak truth to power. He actually rose to become Army Chief of Staff because he was ruthlessly honest with Franklin Delano Roosevelt when Roosevelt was president. He was in the Oval Office as a brigadier general, not a high-ranking general. And at the end of a meeting, Roosevelt rather sort of waved his hand in the air and airily said, isn't that right, George? And Marshall very quickly made two things clear. First, his first name was not George, it was General. They were not buddies, he was not to be addressed as George. Second, he said, I disagree with you. And he told him why. That impressed President Roosevelt because Roosevelt was a master politician. And he knew that somebody as manipulative and as political as him needed people around him who would call him on it, who would throw the BS flag. And Marshall showed he was willing to say, no, Mr. President, I think you're wrong and here's why. He was respectful, but he was clear. And so Marshall, against expectation, became Army Chief of Staff. As Army Chief of Staff, he continued to tell the truth to the president. A crucial meeting before we were involved in World War II in 1939, one day Roosevelt says, well, I'll deal with this military readiness stuff down the road. And Marshall leans over him angrily and says, Mr. President, if you don't deal with this today, I don't know what the world is coming to. You have to deal with it now. And he so impressed Roosevelt that he changed Roosevelt's mind. That's an impressive general. The other thing he did as the general leading the army, first of all, he grew the army from 180,000 people when he took over to 9.5 million people when he stepped down. Okay. He helped win World War II in the process. But he was also very careful not to make excuses for his friends. He fired some of his friends in World War II. One day one guy said, nope, can't be done. He said it three times. The third time, Marshall said, you be very careful. When he said it again, he said, very well then, you're fired.
And, of course, he picked Eisenhower to be supreme commander in Europe, and that was, you know, in many ways an unorthodox decision.
I'm glad you mentioned that. He spent a lot of time, Marshall, thinking about what were the types of jobs he had facing him and what were the right person to put in those jobs. So he said, okay, World War II. It's going to be a war overseas. That means we're going to have to work closely with allies. That means I need commanders who can get along with allies, who can make compromises, but also can be rigid and ambitious and represent American interest, but do it without insulting people.
And also deal with difficult types such as Monty.
Yeah. So he picks this young lieutenant colonel named Eisenhower, who's the executive officer of an infantry regiment on the West Coast. And he starts grooming him and some other guys to take over these big jobs. And he promotes them much faster than you'd expect. Lieutenant Colonel Eisenhower very quickly becomes four-star General Eisenhower. And it wasn't necessarily what people would have done. If he had followed the rules of seniority, he would have picked a guy like George Patton and sent him off to London to be the Supreme Commander. Patton was much more senior. But imagine if crazy old George Patton had been sent to be the Supreme Commander. By 1944, we probably would have been at war with the British.
My guest is Thomas Ricks. His new book is The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today. You know, Marshall was also someone who conducted himself very differently after his military career. He did not go into politics. He did not become a commentator on CBS News. Compare him to the sort of the post-general life of today.
Absolutely right. He's a man who had an almost Roman sense of my war is done and now I want to go home. Now, they wouldn't let him go home. They said, no, you need to. He became head of the American Red Cross. He becomes Secretary of State. For a short while, he's Secretary of Defense. Finally, as he's beginning to go senile and lose his mind, he says, I must go home now. And finally, he does. He served his country. He did not get wealthy in the process. In fact, Henry Luce, the head of Time Life magazines, offered Marshall $1 million if he would write his memoirs of World War II. And that would have made Marshall a rich man. $1 million was a lot of money then. Marshall lived on a salary. He didn't have any money. Marshall turned it down, and he said, if I wrote my memoirs, I'd either have to hurt a lot of people's feelings or I'd have to lie, and I don't want to do either.
In the book, you talk about how the Korean War sort of is where the different approach became institutionalized in the Army, that mediocrity lets you succeed in a way that you think is unacceptable, and that followed on into the Vietnam War. What happened in Korea?
Well, I think the first thing is just bureaucratization of the military. You get a big Cold War bureaucracy. The second thing is it's a smaller, difficult, messier, unpopular war. And it's harder to fire people in unpopular wars because then it raises political questions. So MacArthur goes in and screws up the Korean War enormously, probably one of the worst generals in American history. And they send in Matthew Ridgway at the end of 1950 to clean up the mess that MacArthur's made. And Matthew Ridgway, a great American general, does turn around the war in just 4 months, really improves morale, improves planning, makes it coherent. You no longer get these crazy moves by MacArthur that are exposing tens of thousands of soldiers to Chinese attacks. And he really does a good job in the war, but he says, I want to fire half my regimental commanders and 5 of my 6 division commanders. And the Army says, hold on here, son, time out. If you do that, Congress is going to start asking pesky questions about the war. And he says, well, I want to do it. And they said, okay, you can do it, but you got to lie about it. Just say it's planned rotations, which it wasn't. And in the course of my research, I actually read these documents that are sitting up there in the Army archives in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. It's very interesting. So Ridgway does that, but the Army says, we're not going to go down that road again. We're going to rotate out generals, move people in and out very quickly, and we're not going to fire people for failure in combat. The last American general, until very recently, the last American general fired for combat failure was a guy named Major General James Baldwin in 1971. James Baldwin was the only division commander fired in the Vietnam War, a war we lost. Compare that to the 16 who got fired in World War II, a war we won. Now, recently, we've seen 2 Marine generals fired for combat failures in Afghanistan, and that's a good thing. But it's been too long to go many decades between firings of generals over combat incompetence. Not all our generals are above average, and the U.S. Army is not Lake Wobegon.
What happened in Korea, essentially, that same system, which did not fire people and which allowed people to stay in, essentially continues until today. Let's talk about Vietnam. You're particularly harsh on someone who was regarded very well historically, I suppose, is in many ways Maxwell Taylor, the Kennedy's favorite general.
Taylor, I have real problems with as a general. He was chief of staff of the Army in the mid-1950s, And basically, it was unclear what the role of the Army was in this new era of nuclear weapons. Could you have soldiers on the battlefield, or should we just do away with the Army altogether? And Maxwell Taylor's answer was, we know what, we'll fight small wars. That's what we'll do. And he is put into this new position that didn't exist before and hasn't since, of being the president's military advisor. Now, this was a mess that John Kennedy created because they already had a military advisor. He's called the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. So it's effectively, Kennedy has two different people, the guy who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and then Maxwell Taylor, who's effectively doing the guy's job. And Maxwell Taylor has his office in the White House. He's seeing the president several times a day. Maxwell Taylor, following up on his idea that the Army should do small wars, says, hey, there's this place, Vietnam. That's a good place to show what I mean. And he really encourages Kennedy to get involved in Vietnam. The second big problem I have with Maxwell Taylor is he's the opposite of George Marshall. Marshall had a hard time lying to people. Maxwell Taylor had a difficult time telling the truth.
What happened after Vietnam? Some of these generals who then came to fame in the first Gulf War, that was their proving ground, Schwarzkopf, Powell, and so on.
You get a really impressive rebuilding of the American Army after the Vietnam War. The Army is on its ass in the 1970s. Drugs, racism, indiscipline, officers having to carry pistols just to go into the barracks. And the Army gets rebuilt, and the rebuilding is wonderful, but it's not sufficient. They rebuild the Army tactically, but they don't rebuild it operationally or strategically.
Explain what you mean by those terms.
Well, tactics is what you do on a battlefield, and it's stuff you can train for. Tactics is training somebody to operate a machine gun. And training is about preparing for the known. How do I conduct a tank battle? How do I fire a machine gun? Education is what you give to people for the unknown. It prepares them to deal with complex, messy, difficult situations. How do I go into a place like Iraq and think critically about what I'm facing, figure out what the facts are, figure out what the important facts are, figure out what I'm going to do about it? That requires education. And what we got after the great rebuilding of the Army was an Army that was very well trained, but led by generals who were not well educated. They were trained, not educated. That means they were good tactically, but not strategically. And so you get a bunch of generals, like Tommy Franks, who were very good tactically, but basically, as generals, were just jumped-up battalion commanders. They knew how to be good in the field, but they didn't know how to do the job of being a general. They thought that thinking about next week was somebody else's job. They knew about how to fight a battle. They did not know how to win a war. So we have a very botched ending to the 1991 war, the Gulf War, where we ended early, and where Saddam Hussein comes out of that war thinking he's won. We now know from captured tapes of his cabinet meetings that when we stopped the 1991 war, he said, I don't know why the Americans are stopping. They must be afraid of us. But, hey, I just won. I'm the first Arab ever to take on the United States and Great Britain and their local ally, Saudi Arabia, and I'm alive. In the Arab world, that's a victory. And then we make a similar mistake in 2003. We invade Iraq with a great plan for invading it and without an idea one of what we're going to do once we get to Baghdad, which was the harder problem.
Tomorrow, we'll continue my conversation with Thomas Ricks about his book, The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today.